Welcome back to Understanding VC. I'm your host, Rahul. Today, my guest is Anjali Sosale. Anjali is a partner at Waterbridge Ventures, an India-focused seed to Series A fund that invests in early-stage technology companies. With a focus on consumer tech, e-commerce, marketplaces, and all enablers to Indian consumer demand, Anjali is dedicated to finding and supporting innovative startups that are changing the way Indians transact online. She's particularly interested in products that can enable the next 500 million rural Indian internet users to engage in e-commerce. Now let's talk to her.
Hi, Anjali. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Rahul. Good evening. And thank you so much for inviting me. Really excited to be spending the next few minutes with you recording this together.
Hey, you grew up in Bangalore, right?
That's correct. Yes, I'm born and raised here.
Yeah. Did you imagine that, you know, Bangalore would become this tech hub when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think it's kind of, if I have to describe the city I grew up in, my parents would joke that it was called Pensioner's Paradise. But I'm an 80s kid, so growing up in the 80s, of course, the IT services boom really happened through that. And therefore, tech and engineering talent became a really big thing. Everyone was vying for jobs in Electronic City with the big tech behemoths like Infosys and Wipro. But largely, you're right. I think Bangalore was a sleepy old town that literally became this huge metropolis and with this bustling startup ecosystem through the years. So I don't think through life as a student, I ever imagined that I'd be gainfully employed in Bangalore and I'd always prepared to head out. But here we are sitting in Bangalore, which is pretty much the definitive startup capital of India.
Yeah. So growing up, did you already have like a particular career path in mind?
That's a trick question. I think as most South Indians raised in conservative households, I think your career choices were limited, or let's just say your education choices were limited. So I'm actually a chartered accountant. I'm trained in finance. And it's fair to say that it was my own choosing. And I loved math. I loved investing in money and everything around it. So I think it's fair to say that I always wanted to do something. And very strangely and specifically had a lot of interest from very early on in business, international business, M&A. I should read the newspaper backwards, starting with sports and then global and then business, then come last to domestic and Indian politics. So I think that really shaped me early on and always seemed to have an inclination towards investments and transactions and deal making. Yeah.
You mentioned sports. Any particular sports that you are interested in?
Yes, I have, championship badminton players in my family. And I also have like state level basketball players. So definitely encouraged to take up sport early on and still very much, enjoy, playing badminton over the weekends.
Nice. Any other hobbies that you had growing up?
Well, I used to read a lot. I think till date, I really enjoy reading management books. I enjoy reading autobiographies. Also like sports people. I remember Agassi's autobiography, Open, was one of the books I really enjoyed reading and rereading many years later. But reading is something I did like a lot. And the other thing I continue to do is yoga. I picked up yoga and meditation as actually a student just to be able to cope with all the exam stress. And thankfully, that's the one thing I stuck to and continue to practice every day.
How did you end up in VC in the end?
Yeah, serendipitous. I think as much as I love transactions and deal making, I was late to VC. And I think I was like a tenured professional before I joined Waterbridge at the beginning of the second fund, which was January of 2020. Waterbridge was actually founded by Manish Khetarpal back in 2016. And Manish and Ashish, who's our second co-founding partner, both come from private equity backgrounds from Providence and Actis, respectively. And Manish, like I said, met, back in 2009 when we were working on a transaction together. I spent my first 10 years as an investment banker with Ernst & Young. I largely did sell side, meaning represented founders in either cross-border M&A or fundraising, mostly through private equity sort of transactions. And that's really how I would say the three of us came together. I think even independently from where I was post EY, I spent 3 years at Myntra, like very much at the heart of the consumer internet boom and the e-commerce ecosystem. And in 2018, Myntra got sold to Walmart. And then a year later, Myntra got integrated into the larger Flipkart group. And I think I was ready to move on and also maybe get back to my investing roots after 3 years doing, you know, everything from being the head of commercial to running an accelerator program at Mitra. So I think it was a few things that, you know, beautifully came together. And as they say, sometimes the universe like conspires to get things done for you. And at the same time, Waterbridge was just getting ready to launch Fund 2. We just filed to raise Fund 2. And also, more importantly, set up an office in Bangalore. And given this is home for me and this is the ecosystem that I knew very well and had like deep networks and connections in, it made sense for us to set up a Bangalore office. That's the office that I'm sitting in right now. It's an office we picked up in early 2020, just before the lockdown hit us. And we started going, and today we're a 10-member team here in Bangalore, and almost 50% of our portfolio is actually, you know, founders headquartered and based here.
Yeah. So is this it? Is VC the thing that you want to do for the rest of your life, or?
I'd like to think so, because I think with any investing, necessarily it is the long game. I don't think that you can fundamentally try and yield anything gainful if you just spend a few years. I think unlike tech or other careers where you could like keep jumping frequently, I think with investing, you necessarily, because the investment cycles are so long, it's not possible to be impatient and try and seek results in a matter of years. So you really have to learn to start planning your life and career in decades and not years. And, you know, even my stint at EY was long. It was like a full decade, like I said. So I think it's necessary to really go through those full cycle weeks, the troughs, the ups and downs, see different types of capital inflows, outflows, to really be able to call yourself a holistic, you know, tenured VC. So yeah, I definitely hope so and would like to think so, yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of Waterbridge, right? So I know that you guys have an initiative called Fast Forward. If you could talk about Fast Forward.
Yeah. Yes. So Fast Forward is something that we launched in the second fund. This was, again, in April 2020. It was the peak of India's first national lockdown. And we said, hey, we can't really stop investing. And therefore, we came up with this program based on, you know, three large tenets, I would say. One is that we really wanted to respect founder time. I think more often than not, founders end up sending, you know, cold emails to VC inboxes. You don't get a response. You never know what the feedback truly is on your pitch deck. And we thought, hey, how do we make this process easier for founders? Can we really commit to a particular turnaround time on every pitch deck that we receive? So in Fast Forward, I think the first thing is that we commit to a 7-day response time to every pitch, email, and deck and application form that we receive from founders. I think the second big one is around transparency and just that whole VC founder fit. I think whether you're pitching to the right VC, whether we as Waterbridge are the right backers for you as a founder, is it a sector we like? Is it an area that excites us? Is it a place where we can add tremendous value beyond capital? So we really put like a draft term sheet out there. We called out the six sectors that excite us. We run Fast Forward every year. So every year when we run it, we publish insights and perspectives and theses on sub-themes and sub-trends that, you know, where we're seeking out founders. So we really started putting a lot of information out there on the kind of founders we're seeking so that our ability to actually make an investment through the program increases. And I think the third piece is the collaboration piece and trying to bring the rest of the early stage and seed stage ecosystem together. I think look at it like a common entrance exam for higher education, where a single application should enable you to pitch to multiple VCs. And if all of us are self-selected partners and collaborators in this ecosystem via like a program like Fast Forward, literally that's like our third promise, saying a single application, you know, pitch to 10 VCs. And each of these VC partners are folks who are absolutely complementary to what Waterbridge brings to the table. You know, you could be like a deep tech specialist fund. You could be like a super angel who's been CXO at a unicorn. Or you could be somebody with cross-border US GTM expertise. So we really selected our co-investors pretty carefully and thought of who would be collaborative and, as always, add value to the cap table and build like this little group of investors who form part of the Fast Forward community. So that really, I would say, is the three big, you know, the core vision and mission of Fast Forward. It's to enable seed funding in the hands of the most deserving founders as quickly as possible, in the most transparent way possible. And more importantly, I think Fast Forward, we've made 9 investments across 3 editions. And Fast Forward is not a one-time check. I think there are a lot of programs out there that are either cohort based or milestone based or, you know, sweat equity based or like being one time, you know, grants or checks. Fast Forward is none of that. It's not like a dedicated allocation or separate fund within the fund. It is part of our core fund. And we now have, you know, examples like our investment in, say, One Code or LOLO, where we did sub $1 million checks the first time around. And we've continued to co-invest and double down on these investments through proratas in subsequent rounds as well. So Fast Forward is very much part of the core fund. You get a part, you know, to sit on the cap table, and the value add construct is actually the same. And more importantly, it's not just a first seed check. You do qualify for follow-on funding on par with the rest of the portfolio.
Yeah. So the other VCs that you partner with, right? Those are like angels?
It's across the spectrum. We have individual super angels who join us. We have, you know, smaller VCs or micro VCs, as we call them. We have sector-focused VCs. And then we have large, you know, institutional folks as well. So we have everybody across the spectrum. To give you examples, we have like Uncle Capital that's worked with us. That's a fund that's, you know, very focused on 3 to 4 specific sectors. Core has the ability to write the same check sizes we do. So you could say they're like a peer group fund. We have funds like Inflexor that's deep tech focused, like Arali that's B2B focused. And then we have like other VCs like Way Ventures, for example, that has had like a stellar portfolio in financial services and consumer tech. Also come and join us on these cap tables. And we've also got some global funds. We've got funds like Pureland based out of Singapore that's healthcare focused and really keen on, they don't have a dedicated India office, but super keen on coming into India and doing investments in healthcare. We have Spiral Ventures from Japan that in fact recently appointed an India head, and again, very keen on doing, you know, India seed stage. So I think it's a diverse, eclectic, broad mix. And the reason it necessarily needs to be broad and changing with every, you know, with every addition of Fast Forward is it has to meet the needs of that season and what the market's asking of you that year. And also, like I said, has to necessarily be complementary to what WaterBridge can bring to the founder and their business. Our idea is that founders should have the option to curate and choose who their VC partners are, and they should have the ability to select the best partners, and all of us should, you know, fight and like, you know, earn our right to be on that cap table.
Yeah. Yeah, my initial thought was like, maybe there's a conflict of interest. You know, why would you want to share? Yeah, the deal flow kind of thing. But also, like you talked about, you know, founder having options to choose the right VCs. But how important do you think is for founders to like really do a background check on VCs? You know, that's the fundamental reason why I do this podcast.
Glad you asked it. You know, people rarely ask us this question. So glad you're picking on that one. I think it's super critical. See, at WaterBridge, we are high conviction folks. We've done 31 deals in like 6 years. So we don't do like more than 4 to 6 deals a year. So we are high conviction. What I mean by high conviction is if you're doing only so many deals a year, the probability of deal closure vis-a-vis the number of pitches we see is significantly low. The conversion rates are very low. We also really believe in the value add construct that I spoke about, in a sense that we don't do sectors we don't understand in, or where we feel we can't contribute to in terms of network or helping find your first customer or your first partnership partner, or even like hiring the first set of key talent and people. I think, therefore, it's super important to really study, you know, partner backgrounds. I think very many founders forget that VC firms are also comprise, you know, partners who are people, who are humans, who are individuals, and they are the ones who really sit on your board. And therefore, it's a really, really long-term relationship as well, given, you know, VC is necessarily super early stage. You're talking like a minimum of like 5, 7, 10 year kind of relationship you need to have with this person. So you know, better get along with, you know, what their core values are, what their fundamental beliefs about a particular sector are. Do they have the ability to follow on? When the going's good, everything's great. But when you like hit a bear market, would they still like, when they say high conviction, would they really back you if no one else is backing you? Would they give you that bridge, right? So I think multitude of these factors, in terms of not just what the fund philosophy and thesis is, but fundamentally that partner who's coming onto the board, like I said, is there like a match of minds, vision, thought, and how you fundamentally think about the business, the opportunity, and do you see yourselves being true partners? I think that is also super critical. And I think that's where the magic and the match also happens, when you have a founder that you're really excited about, you're building in a space that you really believe in, and both of you challenge each other equal amounts. Yeah.
Yeah. So can I ask, you know, what percentage of founders that you talk to, like, come prepared?
I think I would say founders, like, rarely ask us the kind of questions that we are discussing right now. I think the most frequently asked questions are obviously what our check sizes and what our sectors of interest are. But founders, you know, rarely, for example, ask us about how much follow-on funding we do. Founders rarely ask us about what kind of equity positions we take on the cap table. Founders rarely ask us about whether we co-invest or whether we like to go solo. So I think whether we take, like, for example, you know, conflicting, competing portfolio bets or not, right? I think these kind of questions we rarely get asked. But having said that, we do get asked the standard, you know, what's your check size? What stage do you like coming in? And I would say with, like, most founders don't fully understand the extent of time and involvement that a VC will have in their business, especially given its early stage. And that's the part they significantly underestimate. As a result of which, they end up making choices which kind of haunt them later on, where you end up choosing to partner a VC who maybe gave you the highest valuation rather than the highest value add.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard you speak about founder learnability and scalability, right? So I think that's one of the most important things. If a founder has that, you know, you don't need a lot of support, right? What do you mean by that? You know, this is at least my interpretation.
Yeah. No, I think, see, entrepreneurship is, like, it's hard. It's possibly, I think it's, like, the hardest thing to do. And if you're thinking and we're saying and our ambition is building generational companies, like building enduring companies that last decades, then you're necessarily going to have, you know, multiple peaks and troughs, multiple ups and downs. And none of us, no matter what our experience in life has been, would have possibly been through or lived through, but it's not even possible to envisage the kind of situations that you'll possibly go through, right? Also, more often than not, you're doing that under severe constraints, because there are different kinds of constraints, not just funding and capital constraints. There are people and talent constraints. They could be, like, demand side constraints, or they could be regulatory constraints. So it is therefore super important that, you know, both as investors and founders, we're really aware of what we know, but as important to be aware of what we don't know, like the unknowns. And I think our ability to call those risks early, or to be able to measure and size up what those unknowns could be early on in the journey, before, you know, waiting for the obvious to happen in front of you, I think that's really what will, like, set apart somebody who will in the long term and somebody who doesn't. And I think more often than not, we always focus on the knowns and what we know, but not so much, like, what we don't know or what the unknowns are. What are those risks? And that's something that you only learn with time. And that's where the scalability factor comes in. You know, one thing is to literally just experience those environments, situations as and when they happen. But the other, like I said, is the ability to catch, you know, as much as it's important to catch trends early on, it's also important to catch risks or call or foresee risks or potential risks, like, early on, and find ways to hedge yourself early on. And that journey is hard. That journey requires continuous learning. What a seed stage company needs is not what a Series A company needs, is not what a Series D company needs. And nobody is designed to know all of those technicalities or all of those skill sets. And therefore, I think it's that continuous, like, you know, learnability index increasing with time, and the ability to be able to hire the right people and to surround yourself with people, you know, fill your gaps. I think that's equally hard for a lot of folks to swallow as well. Like, do I want to have people who could potentially replace me or who are, like, potentially better than me in some aspects? So I think that's, you know, all of this, of course, requires vision, requires you to continuously scale and think differently depending on, like I said, what stage of journey you're building for. Because what you need for 0 to 1 is not what you need for 1 to 20 and beyond. The skill sets are vastly different.
Yeah. And, you know, in India, why don't a lot of founders step aside for maybe the 10 to scaling stage?
You know? Yeah.
Because it's harder to do the 0 to 1, right? Rather than the scaling.
Yes, that's how the matured markets work, right? You're absolutely right. Like, it's the hardest is 0 to 1 is, like, you know, just getting started is obviously the hardest. And as you scale and grow, there are a lot of skill sets that I always say, like, what are the skill sets that can be hired for? And what are the skill sets that need to stay within the founding team? And that are non-negotiables, I think. That's the hardest, just getting off the blocks. But you're right, I think it's very common in mature, developed VC markets that as you scale and grow, you end up professionalizing your C-suite and the founder ends up like stepping aside fairly, you know, in the run-up to either the listing process or immediately after the first round of investor exits, etc. But I think to each their own, India is also a very, very young market. We keep seeing that, you know, VC has just maybe seen one full decade and one full cycle of entry and exit. And we're still maybe only in our second decade of VC. Like, I think 2006, I would say, is when, you know, Accel and Erasmic came together and Sequoia set up an India office. And it was those 2 years where the global VC funds, not private equity, private equity was there before that in India, but the VC funds came and set up shop. We had the first wave of unicorns that decade. And we're really only in the second decade, in the second cycle. So I think a lot more to learn. It's a very, very young ecosystem. Having said that, we also know that there is a dearth of, you know, senior tenured leadership talent, as easy as it is to tell founders, hey, step aside and, you know, hire somebody who's taken a consumer tech company public before. But finding that skill set within the Indian ecosystem as a professional who's done that is also hard, right? And we've seen with a lot of the unicorns who've hired like tech talent from the Valley, in some cases it worked, in some cases it didn't work. I think we're going through that learning process, trying to figure out for ourselves what's best for the Indian ecosystem. So I think it's more a function of maturity and where we are rather than founders' unwillingness to not do that. I think, you know, I work at Mitra, and Mukesh Bansal was a great example of when Mukesh Bansal moved on and Anant Narayan came in as a first professional CEO. So I think it's, like I said, it's maybe more to do with where the nascency of the ecosystem rather than founder mindset. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have run an accelerator with that Mitra. So if you were to look for, you know, exceptional founders, where do you go out looking for, you know, alumni network?
That's a trick question. You're basically asking me to give you my sourcing secret sauce. But no, great. I think great question. And it is obviously hard. As I mentioned earlier, the conversion funnels are like low single digit, like, in our case, given we do 4 to 6, it's sub 1%. So if every like 200 to 400 deals that you see a month, typically just 20% even get to a call stage. And like I said, sub 1% get funded. But it can come from everywhere. I think fundamentally, you have alumni networks, you have the entire, you know, campus and student network where entrepreneurship is bustling. Then you have the accelerator programs, what I call the ecosystem enablers, both that are affiliated and work out of corporates, you know, like the Flipkart Leap program, for example, that sits out of Flipkart or affiliated Flipkart. And the independent ecosystem builders like the Head Start Fund, like the Head Start Network in India, which is, you know, a bunch of startup volunteers and enthusiasts who are like really propelling the startup ecosystem forward and encouraging more people to take up, you know, entrepreneurship. So that's a large, you know, part. And I'll come to the share so that folks also understand which ones finally get converted. I think the second part is just your own first and second degree network, you know, founder references from our own portfolio, leadership references from our own portfolio, other VCs, super angels. So let's put that as the bucket from within the investing and the founder community. And I would say, you know, warm Waterbridge connects in first and second degree networks of the firm and the people. Yeah. And third is the intermediary network, which is your early stage investment bankers, you know, startup mentors, virtual CFOs, CA firms, who are also, I would say, enablers. So maybe two broad buckets is like the enabling part of the ecosystem and in the first and the second degree network. But if you actually see conversion in terms of which ones you actually end up investing in. Sorry, there's a third bucket. Yeah. So there's a third bucket I wanted to talk about, which is the ones where we are seeing the most conversion, which is what we internally call outbound, and which is the, you know, top-down thesis building, you know, put your perspectives out there, invite founders to come and pitch who are building in that particular space that we're calling out as our area of interest for this year. And I think the conversion is mostly in that second and third bucket. Almost 60% is either outbound, where one of us are reaching out to founders, or it is coming in from our first and second degree network. And I would say 40% is the ecosystem enablers. Should be anything from campus to accelerators to intermediaries, and even like cold inbound. So I think we don't have an example of a cold inbound that has led to an investment yet from our portfolio, but given, like I said, we do select investments, we always take lead positions on the cap table. We like to lead our rounds with high conviction. We have seen most success when we have sought out founders. And so I would put in the outbound thesis bucket. Yeah.
So the process would be something like looking at a large market and looking for opportunities and then working backwards, right? So I recently came across a tweet. Now, VC's conventional wisdom starts with huge markets and goes backward as if successful startups are born as large companies. But the approach that founders should ideally take is to start with focus and attack the small segment of a market. So a couple of questions. One, in terms of weightage, would you weigh founders or market? Which one is more important to you?
I'd like to think I believe founders ahead of markets. I think it's easy to pick a market, and especially in a country like India, where every market will be large and deep, but it's harder to find the right founder. And therefore, I would say founder market fit, specifically founders ahead of markets. And it also goes back to the point on scalability we were making earlier, which is it's really important to find a person who has the ability to pivot basis, you know, the changing market conditions and circumstances, who can scale, who can hire the right kind of talent. And I think necessarily, therefore, you need somebody who is given the longevity that entrepreneurship demands of you, and therefore staying power is supremely important. And therefore, you need somebody who's, you know, not just young and hungry, but also has a very close understanding and knowledge of the industry in which they're choosing to build in, and who has experienced or witnessed or solved for that problem statement firsthand. I think you necessarily have to be close to the problem statement in any of these, from any of these vantage points. You could have experienced it, or you could have solved for it in your previous organization. And I think trying to get across to a VC why you so passionately and deeply want to solve this particular problem statement becomes super critical. And that's directly reflected in the speed in which you can execute post-funding. And I don't think any of us want you to learn on investor money. So the big question is, post-funding, straight off the bat, like how quickly can you start getting operationally functional and start getting your first customer, your first employee, et cetera. So I think that's super critical. So when I say founder market fit, I also put founders ahead of markets, yes, but specifically a founder who, as I mentioned, comes with that knowledge and expertise and can articulate as to why are they so close to the problem statement they're trying to solve and build around.
Yeah. So you focus on consumer tech, right? So this is something that I always wanted to know. Does consumer behavior evolve over time? Let's say we can take India as an example, right? So does it evolve over time? Or like, you know, I've heard Kunal Shah mention this, you know, people in Asia are usually after status. So whatever products or services that you can build, which gives people higher status, like for example, Mercedes Benz will sell. So is that how it works? Or in your opinion, consumer psychology evolves?
I think I'd say a little bit of both. Those are like insights, I would say, on behaviors, but something which is so critical and innate. I mean, Maslow's hierarchy will obviously apply, like some needs are critical and necessary, and therefore you have to solve for them first. And then as you evolve and progress and societies and communities become more affluent, you know, you have different need and want sets and therefore different problems to also solve for. So I think it really depends on what problem statement you're solving for, but for which audience and who's your target customer persona. Right. So if you're building, since you took up credit, if you're building for like urban, affluent Gen Z millennials who live in India's top, you know, 10 or maybe top 20 cities, and if they're like 700 million of these Indians, then of course their choices are significantly more than the, you know, the next half billion living in tier 2++, and their needs and wants are different, and they're going to like react and respond and pay for these products and services very differently. And I think it's your ability to know those insights, to know that a customer in a top 20 city in India is possibly spoiled for choice when it comes to fashion e-commerce. And therefore, if I'm a founder thinking of starting up in fashion e-commerce, I'll have to do it significantly differently from all the incumbents are doing. So it needs to be different in terms of selection, in terms of assortment, or do you want to just play the price war? So I think those kind of niches or customer insights are important to understand in the market in which you're solving for. But the same situation, maybe in tier two India, you know, you might be the only fashion e-commerce startup building in that space. And therefore you have obviously first mover advantage and therefore the ability to get that head start and to keep iterating your business model till you figure out what works best. But when you're solving in smaller markets, they're and more evolved markets, they're necessarily more complex and you might have to get into niches sooner rather than later. You decide for yourself specifically who your customer base is, what your price point is going to be, how you immediately decide how's your user experience going to be different. But in large other like broader markets where you're trying to be a category create, like be the first company that's trying to do something in that space for that customer segment, I think there you can take a more horizontal, broad approach and say that I want to build for fashion e-commerce in rural India, but we figure along the way whether it should be a two-sided marketplace, a one-sided marketplace, should it be inventory model, should it be fulfillment, how should we solve for fulfillment? So I think that leeway you possibly have. But I, and coming back to the question, I would say the focus should be on the specific needs and problem statements of like your TAM or your specific audience, rather than broadly painting the brushes like a one-size-fits-all market there.
Yeah. So I noticed a couple of interesting things. I've done some apparel thing stuff in India before. People in the north are like more flashy, right? Than when compared to south. It's one. And the second thing is that, you know, I found e-commerce sales are more in the north rather than the south. Although if you look at it, south is significantly more wealthier. Like, I don't understand the behavior. Is this like a fixed thing or it changes over time?
No, it's like evolving. I think, of course, behavior does evolve. But when we say time, we mean decades. We don't mean like in months. And that's because we're talking demographics. We're talking income. We're talking affluence. We're talking aspirations. And these don't change overnight. They don't even change in weeks and months. They take decades to change. So I think it is true. There are certain things like gold lending, for example, where we're in a company called Yellow Metal that does rural India. They enable disbursement of gold loans in under 30 minutes entirely digitally in the privacy of your doorstep or in your house. And that's something that's been around for decades. And that is going to take maybe a few more decades to change, right? Fundamentally in South India, and this is also very specific to South, women in South India end up pawning their gold when there is need, when there's financial distress and there's a need for cash. That is the first place they go to, the nearby pawnbroker, and the lady of the house like pawns her jewelry in return for cash. So I think those behaviors will take time if you're trying to sell a personal loan product instead to this audience base saying, hey, you don't need to pawn your gold jewelry, I'll just give you like an unsecured personal loan. They might even be suspicious, or even as a founder building in that space, you have to think through a lot more things on how much transactional data, how do you even underwrite something on that? How do you even give them a credit score, right? So I think it's not just the consumer persona and problem. It's also, if you're trying to solve for that differently, you also need to think of the practicalities of the how are you going to build and solve for it before you want to challenge what the norm is or challenge what the usual way of doing, you know, business in that segment and in that market is. So I think it's really an amalgamation of the right customer set, having a large, deep enough market, having a persona that may or may not change in the long term. But just in this gold loan case, for example, it is a persona that hasn't changed for decades and generations. And we've gone in with that known risk of, hey, this will not change for at least a few more generations. But what can change is the digital transformation part, and what can change is the digital enablement part. So we're not going to try and change them about whether they need a gold-backed loan or not. But what we're going to change about their behavior is that this gold loan can be dispersed with eKYC and Aadhaar-based signatures and a digital loan agreement in your doorstep. And you don't need to, you know, drive 40 kilometers in your two-wheeler and wait for 8 hours in a bank branch to get this loan sanctioned. That is also behavior change, that they are finally accepting like digital adoption. But you have to chip away at the smaller parts of it, but significant parts of it when it comes to the efficiencies that this digital transformation will drive to the overall business. So I think it's a mix of both. Are we adopting digital as a behavior change, but the fundamental piece on how I will access and secure credit will possibly, you know, not change for generations.
Yeah. It's interesting that he said this. You know, this is the way I this is a realization that I had as well doing this podcast, that, you know, market has a certain needs. As a podcaster trying to do like a build a media company in the space, I should just trying to do and address those needs in a very, maybe in a, with a fresh take or an innovative approach that might make me stand out. It's a similar thing, not actually trying to change behavior, but then, yeah, still solving it in a better way. So before we started recording, you know, mentioned something very interesting that should build e-commerce companies, because in generally a lot of consumer companies, because given that women makes decisions. Why does that not happen?
Well, I don't know. Women startups, I think they receive low single digit in global VC funding every year. I do know part of the problem is also on the investor side, the fact that traditionally capital pools have been created and therefore controlled by men. But, you know, as we're building more and more consumer businesses, and especially in a country like India, all the decisions around where all the household expenses and all the decisions around where the household expenses need to be spent is actually taken, you know, by the woman of the house, with the lady of the house, whether it's which school the child should go to, or let's say they have significant influence over these decisions. What groceries to buy, you know, where you travel, where you, you know, even buy a home. I think all of these decisions around household expenditure and consumer spending are largely taken by women. But the irony is that when we meet women founders building in this space, it's so much harder for them to raise money over their male counterparts. So yeah. I think we, as much as we debated and discussed that customer personas don't change, I think we grossly underestimate female founders who have a deep understanding of this customer persona, who in many cases are the persona that they're building for and selling to.
Yeah. And we just talked about founder market fit.
Yeah, I think it's important to not look at founder market fit in a binary way, just in terms of, do you have the tech chops to build this product, or do you have the supplier relationships to fulfill what you're selling, or do you have sales and marketing and digital advertising chops? But I think at a very first principles level, it is, why aren't we backing more women who come from this target audience and have a very deep understanding of this, of these buying behaviors and these spending patterns?
Yeah, that should happen more. I think that is a great opportunity for an emerging manager to focus on.
Yes, it is. I think we do our best. And fast forward, for example, since we spoke about it, we actually do commit that every female founder that pitches to us via Fast Forward is invited to directly pitch to a partner on a video call. So we really feel like, at least when it comes to the ability to give access and give opportunity, we have to create nonlinear paths for female founders and women founders. I think there's no other way that we're going to be able to make up for the bias that they face otherwise for funding.
Yeah. One last thing before we end the podcast. Yeah. You know, VCs nowadays talk about profitability being the focus and having real metrics rather than vanity metrics and stuff like that. But why was there a focus on vanity metrics and growth at all cost before this? And that behavior was again driven by the VCs, right?
I think I have a huge grin because this has become every panelist and podcaster's like favorite question to bash up the VCs, given the current environment that we're in. But I would tend to, you know, disagree in parts and agree in some parts. I think at some point in time, and let's start with the parts that I agree with, I think in some points in time, given the overall exuberance, let's put it that way, with India and the bullishness about tech and new tech in India, I think there was like obviously a lot of capital that needed to be deployed and a lot of capital that came in, and therefore in a market where it's classic supply demand, where there's excess capital, you end up making a bunch of quick investment decisions that don't necessarily pan out in this quest to grow really fast and quick. Of course, mistakes are made along the way, and a lot of them are not called out and called out early enough. So there is, you could also say, part of the ecosystem that is part of the problem. But then the parts I disagree with is that I think it works too. It's as much the responsibility of founders to ensure the highest levels of governance, to ensure transparency in reporting, to be forthright in the way in which they interact with their investors and the kind of information they share with their shareholders. But also, also, like I keep saying this multiple times, but like when you actually, when your investment strategy is to do a few high conviction bets every year, you don't necessarily need to play the FOMO game that I spoke about earlier, right? Then you don't end up making some of these decisions because you're not in this hurry to deploy all your capital in a 12-15 month time frame. You have your chosen sectors, you've built your conviction, you know what subtrends, you know, are catching on, you know which themes work, which themes may not work. You know the kind of founder persona that you want to chase, and therefore you can time yourself and you can pace yourself. And in the 6 years that Waterbridge has been around, 31 investments, there have been no exception to this rule. All our investments have been lead investments. All our investments are exactly in the same stage, in the same, you know, ticket size range. In every single case, we've followed on. So I think that ability to, you know, to work within your tenets and to stick to the SOP, even in these exuberant markets when everyone else is trying to be opportunistic, is also, I think, necessary. I think that's the best way to argue it. But I think any which ways, you know, long-term businesses can only be built on real business models. And come back to your overall question on why is the focus on vanity versus value and real metrics. I think anything to win in the long term has to be real. It has to be tangible. At some point, you have to start earning revenue. At some point, you have to start turning a profit. So I think the argument really and the debate and the discussion is really on how long you will to get there, how much capital will you burn in getting there, and how sustainable is that, right? Because the other big question that we always get asked in the ecosystem is all this growth sustainable? And I think if you start building, I'm like a huge believer in first principles thinking, and if you just start building fundamental building blocks the right way, and like I said, if you have a founder who's very, very close to the problem statement and who himself or herself is not building opportunistically, it's not like, you know, hey, e-commerce is the rage this year and everybody in e-commerce is getting funded, or how like EdTech was a couple of years ago and like let's wake up and start an EdTech company. I think it's also important therefore to understand the intent of founders when they are starting up, what the opportunity cost of these founders are when they're starting up. And I feel therefore if, you know, you get a combination of these factors with a high conviction investor, a high opportunity cost founder building in a large deep market that both of us are deeply passionate about, believe in and, you know, bring our networks to work for you. I don't think the arguments in board meetings would be about, you know, vanity metrics. It really would be about how are we, you know, building generational companies.
Yeah. I think, you know, if people were to like look at profitability and things like that for a company like maybe YouTube or something, it would have never happened. I mean, it made only sense at scale. Distribution came down with network effects. So for a long time, a lot of people were supporting growth because, you know, there was a way to make money with scale. But the one thing that I don't understand is, right, like when it comes to a marketplace model like Uber, Bill Gurley talks about this his thesis on how this is going to be really profitable when it scales. But the reality is Uber is still losing a lot of money. So that thesis is wrong, or what is that? Most of the marketplaces are not very profitable. You can look at anything, right? Zomato.
Amazon would be the big exception to that. And Etsy's had a great run as well recently. But no, you made an extremely valid point. I think just take a step back. The other thing that people miss with all these headlines about governance and high cash burn and growth over profit is like necessarily, you know, VC is a high risk, high reward type of a business. You're necessarily meant to create that alpha. You need to take asymmetric, nonlinear risk, and you need to therefore more often than not fund companies who are innovators or category creators. And we were speaking about that earlier about, you know, you really have to create the market in many of these cases. And therefore the upswing and the upticks come in much, much later. But when they do come, given your head start and your first mover advantage and the fact that you created that very market, you know, exactly similar to the example you gave with YouTube or with Google or with Facebook that created these categories, then like on a, when you take like a long-term horizon, it makes total sense. But like I said earlier, it's the ability to see a path to that. I think one is to be delusional about it and think that at some point we'll turn a profit, or at some point our customers will start paying us, or at some point, you know, we'll find an alternate monetization and revenue model and to keep building on that hype and selling that story. And sure enough, maybe getting a few more investors to buy into that story along the way. But in many ways, it comes back to what I said earlier on our ability to know the unknowns, to size up and, you know, measure the risk of those unknowns, but more importantly, to have the vision to call them early and not be totally delusional in the fact that you might turn a profit or you might finally be able to monetize. And I think that's what it is. But all of this takes time. It takes risk. It takes vision. It takes guts. But a critical thing is to also make sure that there is some semblance of reality and you have sufficient people, advisors, investors, mentors around you, you know, doing the reality check on your business model as well.
Yeah. Yeah, this was fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for listening to me, for being patient, for inviting me, and all the very best with Understanding VC, and delighted to be here.